Oh, yeah, right. Moments ago, the chair made an error. But the chair was ill-informed as to our 09 schedule. But he now has a new, fresh piece of paper in front of him, which says that our next meeting in Fortuna will be in April. I guess they heard the chair did not want to go back to weed in April.
Just trying to be incredibly responsive to what you want.
What's wrong with weed?
And for those that weren't there, it snowed that day. So, all right, we are going to go forward and take up item 7, Klamath TMDL. Entertained notion of maybe holding this till later, but given travel times, doing it before lunch is better than doing it after lunch, I'm sure. So. Matt St. John.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. I'm Matt St. John, the lead for our TMDL development unit here at the regional board. Also have Brian McFadden here with me, and Brian and I will be sharing this presentation. Brian is the lead staff on developing the technical portions of the temperature TMDL. So we're here today to give you an update on the status and the approach and some preliminary results for the temperature TMDL for the Klamath River. Our presentation will include our analysis of how flow affects temperatures in the Klamath River as well as the tributaries to the Klamath River. I want to make it clear that we're presenting only as the TMDL development unit staff, we're presenting only on the technical analysis, and we are not at this time presenting on the implementation component of the temperature TMDL, which is in Holly Lundberg's shop with the basin planning unit. So presentation on implementation components of the TMDL will come to you at a later date. I also want to be clear that this is an informational item only, so we're not asking for your direction or approval at this point. It's simply to bring you up to speed, and of course we welcome your discussion and questions, and we'll do the best to answer those questions. So we're going to cover a number of topics. I'll take on the first couple here, covering just an overview of the Klamath River Basin.
Let me just advise the board. I understand this will be a lengthy presentation, as you may tell by the handout, so just be prepared.
Yeah, be prepared, and we welcome, I think you were telling me to be prepared as well as the other board members.
So I just advise you, it's a quarter till 12, and then the board may get restless as you extend along.
Yes. Point taken. So I'll cover an overview of the basin, some of the same points that I highlighted when I came to you at the last board meeting in July. Go over again the schedule for the Klamath River TMDLs and our involvement of stakeholders in developing these TMDLs. Go through what a TMDL is. There's several members of the board that are for the first time hearing presentations relating to total maximum daily load. So we'll go walk through a little bit about what a TMDL is. It's at that point that I'll turn it over to Brian, who will be going through our approach and results for our technical analysis of the temperature TMDL. So the Klamath River Basin is the largest watershed in our region. It is the, as you know, it's a bi-state watershed. It's the origins of the Klamath River start at the outlet of Upper Klamath Lake in Oregon, flow down into California, and ultimately discharge to the Pacific Ocean. In addition to being bi-state, we cover two EPA regions. There's four tribes that have ancestral lands and current reservations within the watershed. There are many rivers and creeks that drain to the Klamath River. In the upper portion of the Klamath River Basin, there's the Lost River Subbasin that originates in California, flows into Oregon, flows back into California, is then pumped into Lower Klamath Lake, and then flows via a drainage canal, the Klamath Straits Drain, and is discharged back into the Klamath River. That's an engineered discharge into the river. It historically, naturally didn't discharge into the river. Moving downstream, the major tributaries to the Klamath are the Shasta, the Scott, the Salmon, and the Trinity Rivers. And then there are multiple creek tributaries that we refer to in this presentation as the minor tributaries. There are five dams on the Klamath River that are primarily for purposes of hydroelectric power generation. Two of these dams are in Oregon, Keno Dam and the J.C. Boyle Dam. There's two just downstream of the state line, COPCO 1 and 2, and then Iron Gate Dam. These dams are owned and operated by PacifiCorp, again, for hydroelectric generation. The uppermost reservoir and dam, Keno Reservoir, is actually operated by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, both to facilitate hydroelectric operations, but also to facilitate discharge, taking of water from the Klamath River system to support irrigated agricultural activities in the Lost River Subbasin, the area that's known as the Klamath Project. And then in addition to these irrigated lands that are in the Lost River Subbasin, the portions of the Scott River and the Shasta River, there's the majority of the watershed is forested, primarily with coniferous forest. The Klamath River Basin as a whole, historically was the second largest salmonid fishery in the state, and populations of the salmonid fishery have declined significantly from their historic highs, given range and fluctuation of those populations. And it's the decline in the salmonid populations over time that are linked to water quality conditions and are really one of the drivers for why we're doing a TMDL now for these waters. This slide identifies the listed water quality impairments, listed meaning on the 303D list, the federal 303D list, for both the states of Oregon and California. So for California, we're doing a temperature TMDL, which, as you know, is the topic for today. We're also doing TMDLs addressing low dissolved oxygen and nutrient impairment. The schedule for completion of the Klamath River TMDL is driven by a consent decree that EPA is working under, and EPA is obliged, under terms of this consent decree, to approve the Klamath River TMDLs by December of 2010. So moving back to where we are today, the Regional Board staff have completed an administrative draft of our Klamath River TMDL. That administrative draft has gone out for a review by our administrative reviewers, and that includes EPA, both regions 9 and 10, the federal wildlife agencies, the State Water Resources Control Board staff that are working on the 401 certification for the relicensing of those PacifiCorp dams, and Oregon DEQ is an administrative reviewer, and then also the Klamath tribes. So we are holding these series of three updates to you on the status of our administrative draft. We will then be receiving comments based on from our administrative reviewers, revising our document, and going out with a peer review version of our TMDL. So that peer review will begin in early winter. It's a 60-day peer review. We'll then get comments back from our peer reviewers, again, make revisions, and go out to a public review next spring, leading to the goal of regional board adoption of the Klamath River TMDLs by a little over a year from now. So again, these presentations are simply to give you an update, to give you a flavor of the direction that we're going, and of course to get your comment and input. As I told you last time in July, we're working on these TMDLs in coordination both with the state of Oregon, their Department of Environmental Quality, and the two EPA regions. We're doing this coordination under the terms of a memorandum of agreement. So we're doing a common analysis, we're sharing resources, we're working closely together, and we're using the services of a technical consultant, Tetra Tech, who is largely funded through EPA funds, but the state of California has contributed significantly to that as well. I want to highlight that we have done a lot of, we have attempted to do a lot of stakeholder involvement. And with this administrative draft, we have had meetings not only with our administrative draft reviewers, but also all of the entities who are to receive an allocation as part of these TMDLs. So listed here are the agencies, federal, state, and tribal agencies, as well as the private entities who we have met with in the course of the reviewing this administrative draft. So that brings us to giving you an overview of what a TMDL is, and I think this is just a helpful time to just step back and remind ourselves why are we doing a TMDL and what the purpose is. So a TMDL is a framework for evaluating and quantifying the factors that contribute to a water quality problem for a water body, and then for developing a strategy to meet the loading capacity and attain water quality standards. So I'll define some of these terms in the next slide. But really what this means is that a TMDL has two parts. There's a technical part that's evaluating how much pollutants the water body can receive and still meet standards. And then there's a policy part of, well, what are we going to do about it? And that's the implementation plan. So to walk through, again, the technical part, some of you have seen this before. We've put together kind of a conceptual explanation of a TMDL exercise. So imagine a water body that under current conditions is receiving pollutants, either point sources or non-point sources or natural sources. So these are natural. There's some amount of natural pollutions coming into this water body, and then there's also point sources coming into the water body as well as non-point sources. So the first exercise in a TMDL is quantifying, well, how much of the pollutants coming in are from natural sources, point sources, or non-point sources. And then the second exercise is determining, well, cumulatively, all in total, how much pollutants can that particular water body receive and still meet water quality standards. And so that is what's referred to as the loading capacity, also called the assimilative capacity of the water body. And so within this assimilative capacity or loading capacity, there's going to be some component, some amount that's natural, and then some additional amount, perhaps, that is can be come from point sources and non-point sources. So from a regulatory standpoint then, what the TMDL requires is reductions from the current amount of anthropogenic sources, both point sources and non-point sources, down to the level that meets water quality standards. And these are referred to as the loading reductions or load allocations as part of the TMDL. Now what's interesting and in some degree unique about the Klamath River is that we're finding that this box is not at all to scale, and that in fact the loading capacity for the Klamath River is largely made up from natural sources. In other words, in order to meet standards, there's not a lot of leftover room for additional anthropogenic related pollutants and meet standards. And that's what we'll go into more detail when we go over the technical temperature TMDL. So the starting point for a temperature TMDL, I've referred to that the purpose is to meet water quality standards. And as you know, there's two components when we refer to water quality standards. The first component is the water quality objectives as defined in our basin plan, and the second component is the beneficial uses. With respect to temperature, we have two water quality objectives for temperature for the Klamath River. The first is the interstate temperature objective, and this is included in the State Board's thermal plan, but refers to the Klamath River. And it refers to the Klamath River as a cold interstate water, and it states that the discharge of elevated temperature waste into the Klamath River is prohibited. And then there's a second temperature water quality objective that applies to the entire North Coast region, including the Klamath River, and this is the intrastate temperature objective. And the objective is quoted in full here. And then I summarize it in the second bullet on this slide. So again, to summarize the first bullet, the interstate objective requires no discharge of elevated temperature waste. And then to summarize the intrastate objective, essentially it says that there shall be no alteration of natural temperatures. Or you can alter natural temperatures, but you must protect beneficial uses. And at all times, you cannot increase temperatures by more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So you'll see that there's two objectives, and the second objective has multiple parts. And so when we're developing our TMDL, we're having to comply with both objectives and the different parts of the intrastate objective. And then I mentioned the second component of our water quality standards or beneficial uses, and identified here are those beneficial uses that are existing beneficial uses designated as existing uses in our basin plan for the Klamath River. And the ones identified with arrows are those that are most limited due to or not fully supported due to the temperature, altered temperature conditions of the Klamath River. Most of these are those associated with the cold freshwater habitat, which implies largely the salmonid fishery and their associated uses, including commercial and sport fishing, as well as subsistence fishing. And then there's also impairment of the recreational beneficial uses, and these are primarily due to blue-green algae conditions, both in the reservoirs as well as in the river. But temperature conditions are exacerbating the blue-green algae condition. So it is linked to temperature conditions as well. So with this overview, I want to walk through the different components of our approach to developing the Klamath River temperature TMDL. We're applying mathematical water quality models as the primary analytic tool for developing these TMDLs. We're corroborating this analysis through empirical data analysis, and of course evaluating the available reports and literature that offer additional insights separate from our empirical data analysis and our model application. When we began the development of these water quality models, we found it necessary to essentially sketch out conceptually both the temperature and the dissolved oxygen and nutrient water quality impairments. And we did this through the development of what we call conceptual models. So we developed two conceptual models, one for temperature and a second one for dissolved oxygen and nutrients. and I want to walk through the temperature conceptual model, because it was really the framework from which we then developed these mathematical computer models. So what this temperature conceptual model, it includes five kind of components. The first component is drivers or stressors. These are the factors that are leading to an altered temperature regime. These drivers or stressors then have an effect on environmental conditions, and so this is the second category of environmental conditions. These environmental conditions then exert a response or an outcome on the aquatic biological community, and that's in this third category of response outcome. And these effects on the biological community transfer into impairment of different beneficial uses. So I'm just walking through these different categories for this conceptual model. The fifth component are what we call risk cofactors. These are essentially auxiliary factors related to temperature, but really separate, that are also affecting both temperature conditions as well as dissolved oxygen and nutrients. So with that overview, let me walk you through an example. In this example, there's a driver or stressor is decreased riparian shade, that is a condition that exists in parts of the Klamath River watershed. Decreased riparian shade is leading to increased solar load. So you have less shade, there's more opportunity for sunlight to reach the water body. That's increased solar load. When you have increased solar load, it causes a change in temperature conditions, both in the diurnal, that's the daytime swings in temperature, hotter temperatures during the daylight and late afternoon hours, and cooler temperatures during the morning hours. And overall, you tend to have increased daily average and daily maximum temperatures compared to a condition where there is riparian shade that is essentially filtering sunlight. So these water quality conditions then have an effect on the aquatic community. In the most extreme, it can cause direct adult mortality as well as juvenile mortality. As well as more indirect, it can cause decreased reproductive success, and overall leads to decreased populations of the fishery community. And this overall decrease in populations of the fishery is what leads to our conclusion that these beneficial uses are not currently being fully supported in the Klamath River watershed. Now, I mentioned these temperature risk cofactors. I wanted to highlight the second one, that when you have an increased temperature condition, increased daily averages as well as increased daily maximums, what results is that you have a decreased capacity for dissolved oxygen to be held in saturation. So this is one of these cofactors, that you have higher temperatures. It is not only affecting temperature, it's also affecting other water quality parameters, and in this example, it's dissolved oxygen. A water body with higher, that is warmer, can hold less dissolved oxygen in saturation than a colder water body. So that's a risk cofactor. A second related one is that warmer temperatures, you're going to have more biological activity, increased bacteria decomposition rates. It's that decomposition by bacteria that causes consumption of dissolved oxygen. These bugs use the oxygen to break down material. That's contributing to overall lower dissolved oxygen conditions. So we went through, this is highlighting one kind of linkage between drivers and stressors down to beneficial use impairments. And we did this exercise covering all of the kind of drivers and stressors that we came up with. And again, as I mentioned, we developed a similar conceptual model for nutrients and dissolved oxygen. It was this foundation of these conceptual models that led us to the application of the mathematical computer models, what we fondly referred to as the Klamath River TMDL models. And I want to describe what these models are briefly for you. Again, these are mathematical models, so it's a computer-based model as opposed to something physical. Let me make that clear. And that what they do is they link stressors, meaning pollutants and temperature conditions, and the sources of those pollutants to the water quality impairments. And these are predictive tools. So once we have a model, we can then essentially ask what if questions, alter input conditions, alter the way that the model is constructed, and see what the result would be on the water quality conditions in the river. And that's what Brian will be walking you through of how we went through this predictive analysis. So there are three different model engines that are used for our Klamath River TMDL. And when our team started working, we reached an agreement with PacifiCorp, again, who's the owner and operator of these hydroelectric facilities, to use the model that was developed by their consultant of Watercourse Engineering to support their application for their license to operate their hydroelectric facilities. So they had developed these models. It was a great starting point for us. We reached an agreement with them, and we used their models. So I want to give credit to PacifiCorp for the modeling work that they did and for sharing them with us. So as I mentioned, there's three models. For the riverine, and what this map shows is color coding, there's the different models that were applied to the riverine reaches, so that's the free-flowing reaches of the river, versus the reservoir reaches of the river. It's the RMA model, shown in this light green, that is applied to the river sections of the river, and then it's CEQALW2 that's applied to the reservoir reaches of the river. And then finally, at the mouth of the Klamath River in the estuary, is a third model called the EFDC, or Environmental Fluid Dynamics Code model. So these models, what they do is you define input conditions, both in terms of flow and water quality. So for example, at the outlet of Upper Klamath Lake, we define what the water quality conditions are and what flows are coming in. And then at all the tributaries that come in, we do the same thing. So like with the Lost River Diversion Canal coming in here, we define what the water quality conditions are and what the flows are. And the same throughout all of the tributaries and discharges into the river. Then what the model does is it runs through its calculations and predicts, well, what's the response to water quality conditions from that loading that's coming in expressed through this modeling tool, and then actually passes from one model to the other the results. So the model churns away and makes calculations for this reach within what's called the Link River reach, passes it to the CEQALW2 model for this Lake Iwana reach, then passes it back to the RMA model for this reach of the river, and so forth and so on. Like any water quality modeling exercise, you begin by, as best you can, making sure this is a tool that we can rely on. All models are simply tools and a representation of a very complex natural environment. And so the first step is making sure that the model is performing as closely as possible to actual observed conditions. And this is a process of what we call model calibration and validation. So we calibrated the model to the year 2000 and validated it for the year 2002. And this is an example. In both of these plots, you have temperature conditions on this axis and the months of the year along the bottom axis. The blue represents the hourly temperatures predicted, simulated by the model. In this upper case, it's at the location is the Klamath River above the Shasta River, and the lower is the Klamath River above Syad Valley. So we're showing both the simulated temperature conditions as well as actual measured data in the orange or kind of rust color. And you can see that for temperature, there, for one thing, there's quite a bit of variability of the amount of measured data. In the case of the Shasta River for the year 2000, we only had about, you know, a couple weeks for several months during the summer season, whereas down in the at Syad Valley, we had a lot more data. But we have felt from the standpoint of the calibration, and particularly for temperature, that the models are predicting temperatures very closely to the observed conditions. I want to make it clear that this is two of about 1,000 plots just like this that are all summarized in a Klamath River model for TMDL development report that was developed by our contractor. It goes through all of the details of how the model was set up and provides all of the output for the model calibration and validation. And this report is available for public review at this FTP site. I guess I want to also mention that the model, prior to our receiving it and then after our receiving it, our meaning the for TMDL development purposes, has already gone through three rounds of peer review. And we'll be going through another round of peer review when we go out for our formal peer review. So it's been a well-reviewed model, both for PacifiCorps's application as well as for our application for TMDL development. So it's at this point that I'm going to turn it over to Brian, who's going to go through some of the details of our temperature analysis.
So I'm Brian McFadden of your staff, as Matt indicated. And I think Matt did a real good job of explaining how models can be used in a general sense to link depictions of conditions to a water quality effect. And so what I'm going to do is walk you through how we've created depictions for the purpose of our analysis that allow us to evaluate the factors that are influencing temperatures in the Klamath River. And there were many modeling scenarios that were developed as part of this larger Klamath TMDL effort. And there's really three of those scenarios that our temperature analysis relied on. And those model depictions, or what we call model runs, are shown here. Current conditions, you know, we need to have a baseline to compare against with the current condition. We had a natural condition scenario, and then we have a compliance condition scenario. And I want to mention that there's another scenario that we'll be mentioning just briefly that you'll see, but I'm going to walk you through how we represented these factors in these three primary scenarios. So first I want to cover what those sources are. Using this very simplified representation of the Klamath Basin. As Matt indicated, the Klamath River begins in Oregon, crosses over into state line, or crosses state line into California, and travels some distance to the Pacific Ocean. So starting from upstream and working our way downstream, I'm going to go through the sources, and the first one is the sources upstream of state line in Oregon. You know, water passes from Oregon to California. And so the water that comes across the border is, the water quality is dictated by the water quality conditions in Oregon. I'll explain what those specific sources are in a moment, but right now I'm just going to get through the list of factors and sources. The next one on our way downstream are the California dams, COPCO 1 and 2, and Iron Gate reservoirs. And immediately downstream of Iron Gate Dam is the Iron Gate Hatchery, which discharges to the river and so has gotten an allocation. We've separated out the major tributaries to the Klamath River, because recognizing their unique ability to influence Klamath River water quality, and those major tributaries are the Shasta, Scott, Salmon, and Trinity Rivers. And We did a separate analysis of how those tributaries affected water quality in the Klamath, which we'll go over. And then finally, the rest of the watershed, which we're lumping into a category called minor tributaries, although it's not meant to belittle those watersheds. They're simply not of the magnitude that have a high probability of affecting water quality conditions, particularly temperature, in the Klamath River. So I'm going to walk us through our allocations and our analysis that got us to the allocations. But first, I need to mention and give a disclaimer that these are preliminary results, draft, and so they're subject to change and revision as we receive comments and information. And so I just want to mention that disclaimer about these results. And so beginning with the sources in Oregon, those sources are point sources. There's two wastewater treatment plant facilities, what has been called discrete non-point sources, which are the Klamath River Diversion Canal, or Lost River Diversion Canal and the Klamath Straits Drain, as Matt mentioned. And then there are two dams in Oregon. We've represented all of those sources in the model, and although those allocations are part of Oregon's TMDL, they figure into the way that we've depicted conditions that affect California. And so I'm just going to go through, for each one of these scenarios, how those are represented in our model. So the current condition scenario is, as you might expect, depicting current loads, both the point and non-point sources, and current flows, and they include the temperature effects of the reservoirs. Similarly, the natural condition scenario does not include the point and non-point sources or the temperature effects of the dams, but it does include current flows, and I know that on the face of it doesn't sit right, but I'm going to explain why we took that approach in just a moment. The Oregon Water Quality Standard for temperature for Klamath River, references natural temperatures plus a 0.3 degree C human use allowance. And so Oregon has crafted their TMDL to meet that standard. And that human use allowance has been distributed amongst all of the sources of heating in Oregon. So that's the way it's represented in the model. And current flows are what is represented in the model. Now, the reason why the model uses current flows in both the natural and compliance conditions has to do with the way that the model was developed the analysis was developed to analyze the effects of these sources and primarily the effects of the dam. We wanted to have a clean comparison of what the water quality effects of the dams are, or what the water quality would be with and without the dams. So in order to do that, we really had to use the same flows, the dams in and the dams out scenario. And part of that is that it's inappropriate for us to try and guess how PacifiCorps would operate their facilities with a change in flow. That's not information that we have or know, and so it would be speculative of us to try and predict how they would operate their facilities with different flows. So that's the primary reason why we used the current flows in the natural conditions scenario and the California compliance scenario. But the reason why that we're okay with it has to do with the fact that there really is very little temperature difference at state line. This is where that fourth scenario I mentioned comes into play. This is the only time that we're going to discuss it. We ran a full natural flow scenario looking at what the temperature of the Klamath River at state line would be given those full natural flows, and compared it to what our baseline natural condition scenario predicts. And as you can see, they're very close. And so we're treating this as compliance with California standards. The current condition at State Line is much different. What we're looking at, and I apologize, I should have mentioned this in the previous slide, what we're looking at is temperature on the y-axis and the months of the year on the x-axis. And so this represents the temperature of the Klamath River. It's the daily maximum temperature of the Klamath River at the State Line throughout the year for our simulation year. And one way to look at this is the difference between the blue line representing current conditions and the orange line representing compliance is the load reduction that needs to occur to meet California standards. It's essentially the load allocation. But a narrative way to say that is that our allocation is for natural temperatures, and that's consistent with our compliance scenario. And so we're looking for no temperature increase above natural conditions. Moving on downstream along the Klamath River, the next source of increased temperature are the reservoirs and dams, Iron Gate and COPCO 1 and 2. The representation of these facilities in the model is pretty simple, as you might expect. Current condition includes the effects of those dams, whereas the natural condition in California compliance doesn't. And that's not to say that we're making a statement about whether or not the dams should or shouldn't be there. We're simply talking about the temperature effects of those dams. That temperature effect is illustrated here in a similar chart that I just as similar to the one I just showed, where in the orange line we have the California compliance scenario representing very close to natural, and the blue line representing current conditions. And what stands out right away is that the dams have the effect of shifting the temperature signal of the Klamath River in time, cooling in the spring and winter, and leading to warming in the fall, also buffering temperatures against atmospheric conditions. And all of that has an effect on the beneficial uses. The salmonid periodicity, or the various life stages using the Klamath River, are shown on the bottom. All these are affected by the temperatures, temperature alteration caused by those dams. So these dams discharge to the Klamath River, and they discharge elevated temperature waste, which is prohibited by the interstate water quality objective. And so our load allocation is crafted to meet that objective, and so the allocation for those dams are no temperature increase above natural conditions, which is consistent with the California compliance scenario. I also want to mention that we've developed a load allocation for temperature for the waters impounded behind the dams, because there's temperature effects associated with those waters, just the nature of impounding water and the stratification that occurs in those reservoirs. But because that allocation is so closely linked to the dissolved oxygen allocation and the conditions in the reservoirs, the dissolved oxygen conditions in the reservoirs, we're going to defer that discussion until our next update, when we're talking about the nutrient and DO TMDLs, to put it in the proper context. So I did want to mention that load allocation has been developed, but it seems more appropriate to talk about it when we talk about dissolved oxygen. The next stop on our tour of Klamath River temperature sources is the Iron Gate Hatchery. The Iron Gate Hatchery does discharge to the Klamath River, although the discharge is very small in relation to other sources and isn't included in the modeling framework that we use. However, since they do discharge to the Klamath River, they're subject to the interstate water quality objective, and so it's a very similar situation as the dams, in which our allocation is crafted to meet that objective, and it's no temperature increase above natural. That brings us to what we've called the major tributaries, the Shasta, Scott, Salmon, and Trinity Rivers. Depicting these conditions required a little more thought, and there's more factors, so I'll walk you through this, but it is a little complicated. And one of the first thing that complicates matters is when we're looking at temperatures downstream of these tributaries, the way that we've constructed the modeling framework, the temperature effects of upstream sources are also manifest in those downstream temperatures. And so it's important to mention that the way that we handled the reservoirs in this analysis, because they influence the downstream temperatures. And so in the current condition, the effects of the reservoirs on temperature are included. The shade conditions in the tributaries are depicted as current conditions, and the flow conditions are depicted as current conditions. In our natural condition scenario for the tributaries, the reservoirs aren't exerting a temperature effect upstream. The shade conditions are, as we've depicted, natural shade conditions, and the flow conditions are our best estimate of unimpaired flows for those tributaries. In the California compliance scenario, again, the effects of the reservoirs on temperature are out of the model. We're dealing with natural shade conditions, but the flow conditions are designed to represent our depiction of what flow conditions would occur given full compliance with the Shasta TMDL, the Scott TMDL, and although the Trinity River doesn't have a temperature TMDL, it is subject to the record of decision, and so the record of decision flows are represented for the Trinity River in this scenario. The depiction of the Shasta River that's a depiction of compliance with the Shasta TMDL includes the 45 CFS flow recommendation. However, because the Scott River does not have a flow recommendation or allocation, the flows have been left as current for this modeling depiction. And at the mouth of the Salmon River, we've made the statement that current temperatures reflect natural temperatures, which isn't to say that there's not work that needs to be done further in the watershed, but down at the mouth of the Salmon, we're saying that the temperatures currently are as they would be naturally because of equilibrium and the travel time that it takes for the water to get that far down the Salmon River. So I'm going to walk you through the results of these analyses. This is a really busy chart, and so let me sort of describe what you're looking at. Again, we're looking at the weekly average maximum temperatures on the y-axis and the months of the year on the x-axis. We've got the different life stages that are present in the Klamath River main stem at any given time depicted here. And then we also have the biological thresholds, temperature thresholds for salmonids, represented with the red lines. So the most restrictive need of these organisms is during their spawning stage, and I should mention that these numbers are from the US EPA Region 10 temperature guidance that were developed for agencies to develop criteria. So 13 degrees C is what fish really need for fully supporting spawning beneficial use. Next is the rearing threshold, and for a non-core rearing habitat, that threshold is 18 degrees C. And for migration, these adult fish need temperatures 20 degrees or below. And once temperatures get up to 22 degrees, fish seek cover. It's been demonstrated both in laboratory tests and in empirical studies, including some in the Klamath where fish have been tagged, and comparing their movements to temperatures that they're experiencing, they find cooler water if they can once the water temperatures get up to 22 degrees. And so the current condition in the Klamath River and this is just downstream of the Scott River, is not a good one for fish at any of these life stages, for the most part. If we add in the results of our California compliance scenario, where we're trying to depict what conditions would be given TMDL compliance in the tributaries, we see some benefit. And it's measurable and significant. One thing to point out is the amount of time that that is gained from, for instance, the migration, I mean the spawning needs, where in the current case, the temperatures don't get cold enough to fully support that spawning need until almost November. But under the California compliance scenario, that changes to the second week of October, generally. Keep in mind that it's a fairly short spawning season. And actually for Chinook salmon, which are the main spawners in the main stem, it's even shorter than presented here. We're talking about a 5 or 6 week period starting at the latter end of September. So that represents a big impact on the amount of time that can that these fish have to get their spawning done. If we add in what we're depicting as natural conditions, it doesn't affect the spawning so much, but we're seeing other decreases in temperature that are meaningful in terms of the biological significance. So this is, as I said, showing conditions downstream of the Scott River. We have a similar chart that shows the same information, but it's downstream of the Shasta River. And again, there's this measurable change in temperature that we think is rather significant. But it's also important to keep in mind that the changes that this graph is showing and represents also includes the absence of the dams. In all cases except for the current condition.
Just clarify, it's representing that the dams aren't having a temperature effect.
Right.
The dams can be there. There could be a way in which the dams can be operated and meet compliant temperatures. And so what this represents is that the dams aren't affecting the temperature change.
So thank you, Matt. Yeah, I truly did mean to...
So let me inquire on that point. Are you saying that in the modeling you just say that temperature is identical with or without the dam, or are you saying that you said earlier you're not altering the operations of the dam, so it's just a mathematical change? You're saying if it's 10 degrees with the dam, without it would also be 10 degrees or whatever?
As Brian mentioned, that the interstate objective says no discharge of elevated waste. So our representation of a natural and a compliant condition with that objective is to represent it with the dams out. And our allocation, as Brian's about to get to, reflects that. An allocation does not, we're not making a finding of how the owner and operator of this facility meet that allocation. And we've done some assessment to indicate that it's possible for it to be met with the dam set.
Well, somewhere you've lost me in terms of dams in, dams out, and model. You don't need to talk about the operations because I understand you're not touching that, but just to the model, how does the model function?
Which is our way
and
of
how
calculating.
How do you do that?
It's changing it from a model construct, going back to our map of the.
Yeah.
Changing it from a model construct that goes, going back. where we're going from the RMA model, which is the riverine, which represents riverine, to the sea qual model, which represents reservoirs, to using a single model, the RMA model. Literally, what that means is literally in the depiction of the physical conditions within the river, those dams are not in that depiction. They are out. So there is no impoundment represented. It's a free-flowing river.
And so, in a chart like this, the river would be all green, and the sea qual W2 models would not be functioning in those scenarios.
And you would operate the, so in the blue area now becomes green, and do you change for the tributaries, the minor ones coming in and out under that flowing condition, or do you just jump from the green? Does the model just butt together two green things, or do you actually do recalculation for the blue area? I guess simplest way of asking.
Yeah, it is recalculated. Basically, it's a separate modeling framework that represents the river as it was before the dams were there, with the effects of the tributaries that flow into those reaches also evaluated in the model.
It helps me in terms of it. It amends what I heard you say earlier, that you had RMA and CE and they were separate and one butted against the other one. Now you're saying RMA just, you turn it loose and it goes from top to bottom, RMA.
Yeah, there was no intent to be unclear, and we apologize. But when we're representing current conditions, it's that representation is using three different models. In order for our natural conditions baseline scenario, as well as this draft California compliance scenario, it's representing a free-flowing river condition. And that was because it's very linked to our intrastate and our interstate temperature objective that refer to natural receiving water temperature. So in order to represent and depict what natural receiving water temperatures are, the only way we can do that is through a run-of-river condition. When we then, we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but I think it's okay for the discussion. When we then needed to then quantify what the impact of the presence of the dams are, we took that compliant condition with the dams out. In other words, changed the loadings from upriver, so the point sources in Oregon and the discrete non-point sources in Oregon have been dialed down up to the point that you just had that 0.3 degree cumulative increase above the natural. We then, in the modeling framework, put the models back and the dams back in. And so then we could actually quantify the change in temperature with those dams in. Back in. And it's that allows us to actually make the allocation to the dams for temperature. I think that, what we're getting from your looks is that we need to work on how to explain this better. So that's why this is, we're presenting a draft. And this is get you familiar with these concepts, and we'll work on telling the story. But then by the time we're here, for you to make a decision about this. Okay.
Good-o.
All right. Well.
We need a staff workshop that's public and accessible.
Continuing and discussing the allocations to these dams. Or to the major tributaries. The draft Klamath temperature TMDL doesn't include a load allocation for flow related to these tributaries. That's not something that we've prepared at this point, but we're going to be considering the feedback that we're going to be receiving from the administrative draft reviewers and our peer reviewers and the public, and of course any feedback that we get from you. We'll be refining our natural tributary flow analysis to put it into better context. and evaluating implementation opportunities such as alternative compliance measures and things that could be done to affect some sort of change. That brings us to the minor tributaries. And really, the minor tributaries represent the rest of the watershed. Most of the watershed is drained by these minor tributaries, I think. And we have two allocations related to what we're calling the watershed-wide allocations. The first is related to sediment discharges. And that allocation is zero temperature increase caused by substantial human-caused sediment delivery. What we're getting at here is the situation depicted in this picture where a large amount of sediment discharged to a tributary. This has happened in the past through failure of stream crossings or road fills and also landslides in timber harvest units. In 1997, there was quite a lot of that happened, and a really good report that quantified the effects of those situations, and including the effects on temperature. It is a significant effect on temperature, because as you can see, when these sorts of things happen, the channels get obliterated, and the riparian vegetation is lost. The width to depth ratios change. Pools fill in. It has a lot of effects that can then have a secondary temperature effect. The second watershed-wide allocation is an allocation for shade. That allocation is zero heat load from excess solar radiation. It's consistent with all our North Coast temperature TMDLs, the way that we've dealt with that factor. So that brings us to the end of our discussion of all the allocations and the factors and the way that we've analyzed those factors. And so, to summarize, our next steps are going to be, of course, to come back and continue giving you an update with an expanded discussion of model representation and formulation. We're going to be making revisions to our draft per the comments that we get, and we'll be submitting it for yet another round of peer review. Well, it's first round of peer review for our document, although the model's been through a number of rounds.
So that we're aware that it's 12:45 and probably bellies are ready for lunch, but at the same time, this is what Brian and I spend a lot of our time on, so we're happy to get into as much detail and answer your questions as you would like. Another alternative that I'll just mention is that if you don't want to do it if you want to have private briefings, we'd be more than happy to do that and come to you to do that. But with that, your questions and comments.
Okay, board members. Mr. Corbett.
I just had one. Assuming I understood you correctly, that on your separate major tributaries, which then flowed into natural flows, is your assumption in the model that needs to be reconciled to main stem Klamath maximum temperature loads, I heartily approve. And I think that's what you folks said.
Yeah.
Because that cures a methodological flaw of where the some of the actual conditions might be greater than the whole of the separate TMDL parts, in effect.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mr. Massey.
You got to do a better job of telling me how a dam that is there isn't there, and then it isn't there when you want it, but not there when you don't. No. Because I'm confused by that.
We'll have Donovan. That. First there was a mountain, then there wasn't.
All right. Well, obviously, it's very detailed and complicated, and we ain't got it all yet. So,
I want to just mention that we really struggled trying to find that balance between presenting enough of the detail and not just boring you to tears with those details, and also keeping a general sort of overview of it that helps you all take it in all at once and put it all these things into context. So your feedback about how we did on that is great. Appreciate it.
In terms of the rollout early on of the administrative draft, the list of agencies, what's involved in that? And I mean, at some point you have an administrative draft, and then you get a public review draft or something. I mean, who should see it when it's still administrative?
Matt St. John, again, of your staff. The administrative draft reviewers include U.S. EPA Regions 9 and 10, the Federal Wildlife Agency, so that's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, the State Board staff, essentially our staff counterparts, Oregon DEQ staff, and the tribe, the Klamath River Tribes. The material that's in the administrative draft was summarized in a PowerPoint presentation that was longer than even this. That was a presentation that took us 3 hours to go through. And we had those, we gave that presentation to a larger audience, including those entities that will be recipients of allocations. But they did not actually receive the entire document. So that included meetings with, the last one will be 2 weeks from now with the U.S. Forest Service. We've met with the California Department of Fish and Game, who will essentially be the responsible party receiving the allocation to the Iron Gate Hatchery. We've met with PacifiCorps, the operator of the dams, and we met with the Klamath Water Users Association.
And the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation.
Thank you.
And that covers the full group that will receive allocations, or there are?
That's correct. Yep.
May I make a comment?
Ms. Dean.
I'd like to make a comment. I have aging eyes, and I find the blue background and blue print very difficult to read, both on the little PowerPoints that we have and on the screen. So whatever you do in the future, if you could please see that they are more,
sure.
There's more contrast,
great.
It would be helpful.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Norton?
Can I go back for a minute? Just that in looking at TMDLs, and we've picked off a couple of the TRIBs, and now we're going to MainSTEM, and we're linking MainSTEM back to TRIBs again, and specifically 45 CFS out of the Shasta, which we are assuming we're going to get, right? That contributes a cold water contribution that helps get allocation and compliance with the TMDL, temperature TMDL in the Klamath. It seems to me that there's a lot of back and forth that could effectively, these TMDLs are going to bump up against each other pretty hard, and that compliance with TMDLs and load allocations then are necessarily maybe not static, but they have to be dynamic, and that they are so linked. Do you want to just comment on that a little bit, and how maybe, I mean, does that cause a reopening of Shasta TMDL or a change in Shasta TMDL perhaps in the long run, if it's fact or fiction?
At this point, the way that our findings based on our analysis are that the Shasta, the Scott, the Salmon TMDLs as written are sufficient to meet standards in those tributaries. Now, with regard to the 45 CFS goal in the Shasta River TMDL, I want to make it clear that that was a goal, but the actual allocation, how the allocation was crafted, was to have a certain temperature decrease at certain compliance locations to be achieved through some flow regime. And what we said is, hey, we've identified that if there was increase of 45 CFS from this particular location of Big Springs Creek, you'd reach it. But as you know, and I welcome Samantha Olson chiming in with her experience in Division of Water Rights and water permit law, the Regional Water Quality Control Board has no authority over those water rights permits. And so the Shasta River TMDL was not making a statement about any change to those water rights permits. It is our hope and intent through implementation of the Shasta TMDL that we will have seek alternative compliance measures through creative solutions like water trusts and some of the work that the Shasta Valley RCD is already doing, looking at how they can better manage tailwater and therefore perhaps reduce the need for reducing diversions, that we could increase cold water flow from the Shasta River. I want to go on to just say, so at this point we're not anticipating the need to change those already approved TMDLs. Now what our flow analysis from the Shasta, the Scott, and the Trinity has shown us is that increased flows out of particularly the Shasta and the Scott would result in reductions in stream temperature in the main stem Klamath River. What we as staff have not done is made a finding that increased flow is needed to meet the temperature objectives and meet fully support or better support the beneficial uses of the Klamath River. That's what we're still working on. That was kind of Brian's conclusion regarding that flow analysis. Now, it's our belief that even if staff were to determine that additional flows out of the Scott or the Shasta were necessary in order to meet standards, those would be in the context of the Klamath River TMDL and would not require a reopening of the Shasta or the Scott, because the Shasta or the Scott and the Scott TMDLs were for their subbasins alone, and the TMDLs and the associated implementation plans for the Scott and Shasta were sufficient to meet standards within those subbasins. I hope that answered your question, Dave.
It does. Okay. Just that they're linked, Matt. I see them. There's definitely a linkage between these tributary and regimes that have been set up for these tributaries. And as we go through the process of discovery, because that's what this all is to me, and trying to figure this whole thing out, and I appreciate the complexity of it, they affect each other. They have to. They're linked. They're inextricably linked.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mr. Hale.
Matt, just teeing up on the on the Shasta. So if we get increased flows coming in and temperature reductions, have you looked into diffusion modeling to see how far downstream those temperatures will propagate?
Brian, as part of our flow analysis, has done some very basic mixing equation spreadsheet models, and we have looked at that, how far down they propagate, and we had more that we could have showed you of our flow analysis,
sure.
And with input from management and council, there was a decision to put it in context of the entire temperature TMDL. So that meant needing to show you a little less of that flow analysis. But yes, the answer is yes, we've done that.
Can you give me a hint on how far downstream
it cools the river?
Yep.
Oh, we could say that by the time the water travels to Syed Valley, which is about 60 miles downstream of the Scott River, the temperature effects that are seen at Scott River are still noticeable in there, but the current condition versus the depicted condition look very similar.
Okay, and that's using a fully compliant TMDL with 45 CFS out of the Shasta.
That's true for the natural conditions,
yeah,
there too.
Okay.
Mr. Corbett.
Yeah, I want to try one more time on this water rights versus water quality. You're absolutely correct. This region board has absolutely no authority to affect a private water right. The Shasta was merely a temperature regulation as to a quantity of water. You have a third category, and that is the quantity of water to meet a water quality standard, and certainly Judge Roby in his decision upheld that right. and this I'll throw to Samantha, as far as I know, while the state board has exercised that, there's not been an approval either way or a denial of a regional board authority to do that, although clearly under the Port of Cologne Act we'd have that authority.
And I'll just chime in that on our next steps implementation is planning to research this, and at the very least, I think the flows present creative opportunities for alternative compliance scenarios. And so you'll be hearing a lot more about this interesting area of the law as we move forward.
We await. All right. I have a couple of speaker cards. Go to
thank
that.
You. Thank you, board members.
Thank you. Ken Fetchko.
Hello, Chair and fellow board members. I'm Ken Fetcho. I'm the Assistant Director of the Yurok Tribe Environmental Program. I manage the Yurok Tribe's water quality monitoring, assessment, and regulatory programs. And I'm just here to, we were meeting with staff yesterday on implementation to discuss some sort of creative steps and recommendations, then also to hear Brian's and Matt's presentation today. And I'd just like to commend your staff on the TMDL team. I think they're highly dedicated and qualified staff, and Elmer's loss was a loss to you guys, but also to the river and to the Yurok tribe. I'd also like to voice support and commend your staff for the consultation and outreach they've had with the tribes. I feel that it has made the TMDL a better product, or will make the TMDL a better product, and that in part maybe some of the comments we've given your team has delayed the progress of the TMDL, but that is a good thing. And not only have they outreached to us for comments, but they have incorporated our comments. And we feel that those are improvements over the Scott and Shasta TMDLs. And we'd also like to voice, the Yurok Tribe would like to voice support for that, the 45 CFS recommendation in the Shasta TMDL, and feel that is that potentially may be consistent with the state board's priority plan that they adopted September 2nd, where they mentioned water rights being addressed in TMDL. So I feel that that is consistent with the state efforts as well.
Okay.
Thank
Any
you.
Questions? Thank you. Susan Corman.
Hello, I'm Susan Corum with the Creek Tribe on the Mid-Klamath River. Thank you for staying a little longer and going hungry so that we can go home to our families before midnight. I would also like to say I was very glad I could be here this morning for the resolution for Elmer. I wasn't able to come to the memorial, and it meant a lot for me to be here with this family and the people that love him. So, thank you. It's a little emotional for me, but some of the comments that I have on the presentation today is I was seeing adult upstream migration on the little chart that had the calendar, you know, from January to June. January, it only had fall Chinook in there when it needs to have spring Chinook. Spring Chinook used to be the dominant run in the Klamath. So we need to make sure that the migration needs for temperature and nutrients and dissolved oxygen are being met for spring Chinook as they travel upriver, especially once the dams are opened up either through removal or through fish passage. We should be able to introduce another run, or the old run used to come in even earlier than the spring Chinook now because they had so much further to go through. So they'd come in. I don't even, John would probably know better than I exactly when the fish used to come in, or Ken, but not a water quality person.
Did they come through bulrushes? Is that what?
Also, I'd like to have, this is why we have to feed you before we talk to you, right? Also, I'd like to express my support for needs for flow allocation, definitely for the major tributaries, for the Scott, for the Shasta, especially for things like for migration for fall for fish. They need to, a lot of the fish end up getting locked up in the bottom of the canyon reaches, and then they spawn down there because they can't make it any further up into the tributaries. And then as we had two winters ago when we had all those rains, we had lots of flooding up where we were, and a lot of what's going to happen is because you had the fish spawn in the canyon reaches, all those reds are going to get washed right out. They're supposed to be up in the higher, lower gradient areas, so we need to be able to get them up there so that we can support that beneficial use that affects all of us. Also, I don't know, do you have the packet with the presentations? If you look at page 14, and it talks about Let me look at page 14. The very last one on the bottom, it says, at mouth, current salmon river conditions are considered natural. Now, I'd find that a little hard to believe since we have a temperature TMDL for the Salmon River. So those conditions aren't natural. We have huge temperature impairments in the Salmon River, not as huge as some of the other tributaries, but there's a loss of riparian, there's huge tailing piles. Until 1980, they were still salvage logging into the banks of the river. So you can't tell me that the temperatures coming out of there are natural. They're impaired. So maybe those need to be adjusted for what the Salmon River should be. I'm not sure how that works, but it's just something that I noticed. Another thing I wanted to talk about is Mr. Hale's question about how far does the temperature affect if we add more flow, does that make it downriver? Well, that is an important question for us and for us studying the fish and the water quality up there. That's not the only question. The other question is, the other thing is, it's going to provide refugia for the fish. And that is going to be critically necessary, especially as fish, we get more fish in that are going to be moving up past the dam, are going to have to go up fish ladders, say there are fish ladders, or when they get put in. They're going to need places to hold and hang out. And right now, they don't have those. The Salmon River was 26 degrees the other day when I was there. 26 degrees. The fish are not, that is not a refugia. That is a spring-fed system. It should be warm, I mean, it should be cold. There should be lots of water. The fish should be able to pool up right there to be healthy. And also, right now, we have is Beaver Creek. So we have this huge area with no refugia for these fish. And I'm hoping we're going to get more fish as we have, you know, the fish passage or no dams. That's what we're all hoping for. We want to make the run stronger so everybody benefits. So that's what I also see, is we get more flow allocations, we're going to get colder water temperatures. And I thank you for staying a little late, and I'll see you guys in October in Weaverville when we talk about DO and nutrients.
All right.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Just before you go, in talking about the life histories and periodicities on the thermographs, on those annual thermograph charts, other species and life stages, what about for other salmonids, coho and steelhead?
I think the coho seemed to be pretty adequately represented, but my main concern was, I didn't look for steelhead, was for the spring chinook, just because that's such an important fish to the Creek tribe.
Sure.
And I, it's one we're really, I mean, we had 90 fish a few years ago come up. We really need to make sure those guys are protected.
Right. Okay.
I'll look at it, though, and I'll have our fisheries guys look at it.
And just generally, the steelhead are a little hardier, both as to gradient, temperature, ability to... So I certainly think we ought to consider all species, and we certainly ought to consider the spring run. With the proviso, because of the temperature, the run timings are a little off right now, and we may have to adjust our data to that. But I think if the steelhead are most likely to be doing well before the other salmon species.
Well, and again, with the springers, we're going to really need to be careful about those pockets of cold water refugia as they move up. Those are going to be crucial and vital, and I'm sure the staff's going to talk to you guys more about what they're doing to enhance refugia in the tributaries.
Yeah, so maybe not life stage of the fish itself, but what life stage is represented at that time of year in the river.
Right,
so.
And the adults was not on there, is what I saw.
Well, in a little bit, the out-migration is just a critical time period. I noticed that, too, but I thought I would refine that in meeting with our folks.
Right,
but.
And we'll be doing some, we got an agency draft review. They included the tribes on this, so we will all be doing written comments, too, that will be submitted to them. So.
And I say that because this year we had the unfortunate situation where the Bureau of Reclamation has very rigid guidelines for when they keep the lake level up for Klamath Lake. Even though there's a huge snowpack because the weather temperature was cooler, they then began reducing the water at the one time the fish needed it. Then as the snow melted, when the farmers needed the water, then they were releasing it for the fish. So getting the timing down on the out-migration will allow a lot more efficient use of water in the system and can hopefully avoid having water denied to fish when they need it and water denied to farmers when they need it. So,
thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming.
Wonderful balance.
Yeah. That's all the cards I have, but I know we have representatives from EPA here. You want to make any comment? We're welcome to it. Or anyone else? Don't want to cut it off if it's both a very important issue and one that's on the front end. So it's, we don't know all. I mean, there'll be lots of details to follow. I trust.
Sounds like it.
All right. I don't see anybody rising. Any board member comments? I